Hello, this is Dennis Emery. I'm here with Greg Hill. Greg, let me ask you a question. Are you the greatest player in the history of Henderson, Kentucky?
I don't know about that. I'll tell you what, believe it or not, there was a guy called Chet Allgood.
Right.
Who ended up playing at Kentucky, but he was so smart, he wanted to be a doctor and became a doctor. And I'll never forget it, was playing some pro tournaments and came home, and the guy hardly ever played. And he, out of the blue, wanted to play a set. We played a set, and I think I might have won 7-6. But the guy wasn't even playing, and he was like working on his doctorate degree. So that guy was something else, I tell you, Dennis.
Yeah, he was a little before my time at Kentucky. Well, Greg, let's talk about how did you get started playing tennis in Henderson, Kentucky?
Well, my dad, he was the school principal, and in the summers, I think he had some baseball fields he was taking care of, and there had to be some tennis courts there. We started playing on some steel nets. My brother was tagging along. He's 4 years younger. And we got started in that, but he actually started when he was getting his master's in Murray. He played basketball at Murray State for, actually the assistant was Vinny Purcell, and, started playing down in Murray. But, I actually got started, in Henderson when he was doing some baseball fields in the summertime.
Gotcha. Now, how strong
and to add to that, Doc Hotsback, who, was inducted into the Kentucky Hall of Fame a few weeks back. He had a program, and that's my dad would drop me off in the mornings and pick me up at lunch, and Doc would kind of look after me. And he had a great program and really cared about the kid. And he's been responsible for numerous thousands, 10,000 kids playing tennis in Kentucky. He was unreal.
Yeah. Very worthy inductee into the Hall of Fame. Your dad, was he a high school coach?
My dad was he was a high school coach. He was the first coach at the new high school. They built a big high school there at Henderson County. He was a high school coach. So to answer the question, he was, and then became the tennis coach.
Gotcha. And did he coach basketball at all?
Yeah, he was a high school basketball coach there for a year or two and did a lot of traveling and, He really wanted to spend time more with us boys and my mom. And so he got out of that. And I think he got into tennis, which enabled him, you know, not to travel as much and go scout. I guess back in the day, you had to spend a lot of time on the road scouting other teams. You know, the head coach had to do all this stuff by himself.
Yeah. Okay. Just before we go into your stuff, how strong is the connection between the Hill family and the Purcell family?
Well, it's pretty strong. I mean, we don't necessarily stay in touch, but, you know, they had a big reason into us, you know, with our athletics, because as I said earlier, Benny Purcell, he was actually the assistant basketball coach at Murray, where my dad was on the team. And then I always looked up to Mel. He was 4 or 5 years older than I was. And my brother looked up to him as well. He was always the best player, you know, in the pros out of Kentucky. And we had that connection. And I think I played him when I was in 7th grade. He was in 12th or 11th grade. You know, obviously he killed me. But just seeing some of the shots he hit was such a motivator for me. Like one of the shots when you hit over his head, he'd go back. Everyone does tweeners now, but he would let it drop and do a scoop shot like 5 inches off the ground with his forehand. It was like really, really cool. So he did stuff like that he was so motivating and he was, you know, charismatic and really played to the crowd. He was awesome.
Yeah. Now that had to be with you and your brother, Scott and Mel, Chet Allgood, as you mentioned, that had to be sort of the golden era of Western Kentucky tennis. I mean, would you agree with that?
I guess I would agree. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure about, like Bimo Patel. He was a little later, came out of Owensboro, but I'm not that familiar with the other cities. Obviously Louisville, but in Western Kentucky, I would say that's probably, accurate. The Purcells, the Hills, There's a guy, Scott Plain, was pretty good out of Owensboro. And then Vimo came later, you know, down the line.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your stuff here. And before we talk about the tennis, you were also a great basketball player. Tell us just briefly, who recruited you in basketball and why did you decide to go into the tennis instead of basketball?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So I grew up a basketball player predominantly and then picked up tennis. Well, I guess I started on both at the same time when I was a little kid, 8, 9, 10 years old, and then played baseball. Then baseball had to stop because I was missing all the games, you know, for tennis tournaments. And I was a pretty good quarterback. That might have been my best sport. And then one day in the ninth grade, we had to do some line drills and I had to go up against some linemen. I didn't like that. So I quit that. So I narrowed it down to basketball and tennis. And so my junior year, I started for the basketball team, averaged like 14 and a half points and had a really good game, like 26, 27 points on Owensboro Senior that won the 5A championship that year. And had really only played three games. They wouldn't start me my sophomore year and had no experience. And I don't want to say I dominated. We lost by 3 points, but I had a great game. And so anyway, the season ended and decided to go play a national, the Easter Bowl up in New York City. And I beat Paul Anacone, who was number two in the nation in the 18s in straight set. And that's really... I came home and said, I know I'm not the best basketball player, Dad, you know, even top 10 in the country. And so I'm going to go tennis. So he kind of agreed and we got on a plane. We flew down to Longboat Key. We met with Nick and he gave me a full scholarship there.
Nick Volitieri.
Nick Volitieri. Yeah. It was called the Nick Volitieri Tennis Academy. You know, now it's called IMG, International Managed Group Academies. A full ride and you know, got to play against guys like Eric Carita, you know, ended up with the biggest serve in the world at the time, played at SMU. Paul Anacone, just a lot of great players, even girls like Carlene Bassett, Kathleen Horvath. It was just amazing. Guys would come in like Chip Hooper, Ron Hightower, Jay Lapidus, just incredible. Rodney Harmon, incredible players. So it exposed me. And to good players, and you know, and it kind of would bring you down a little bit, but it could also build you up when you play against them every day, you're not so intimidated. And that, I thought that was a big key for me.
Now, you played when you met Nick, you mentioned Longboat Key, so that was before the Nick Volitieri Tennis Academy in Bradenton.
That's correct. So, it was called the Colony. The right. Colony Beach Hotel on Longboat Key, which used to be the number one tennis resort in America for many, many years. And that was the main site that we would play. And then they bought another club on 75th Street, which was the other venue. So they had two venues to play. And you would rotate, you know, a couple of times at each of those every week. And obviously, everyone always loved going to the Colony because we do beach runs and all that sort of stuff. And right there on the beach, it was beautiful. There's something about, you know, being, as you know, you spend a lot of time in Anna Maria Island and Longboat Key, having that island feeling, you know, and it just makes you feel good.
I know Nick was obviously very influential. I've heard you tell the story before of your dad wanted you to go there and Nick wanted you to go there, but your dad felt like he couldn't afford it. And Nick said, I'll give you, how did that conversation go?
Well, yeah, we met Nick and he goes, I hear you're a really good athlete. He goes, you know, but we got a bunch of really good players and I'd love to give you, I'd love to offer you a half of a scholarship. My dad said, well, Nick, you know, I'm a school principal. We don't have any money. And he goes, okay, all right, I'm a fair guy. He goes, I'll give you a 3/4 scholarship, Nick said to my dad. And my dad, I'll never forget it, put his hand on Nick's shoulder. We were sitting at a picnic table. And he put his hand on his shoulder and said, Nick, we don't have any money. And Nick goes, okay, I'll give you a full scholarship. just like that. And he was working it, you know, the business side of Nick, and that's how that all started.
What was your impression of Nick as a coach when he was working with you at that academy?
Well, you always had to be on your A game with him, and the dude was just major, most intense guy I'd ever been around. You know, everyone's kind of walking on pins and needles and or on eggshells, and he would get the most out of you because you knew you had to perform no matter if you had issues off the court. But at that time, you wanted to do well in front of him because he had a system like a farm system where the better players were always on the top courts, and everybody was fighting to be up there on Nick's court, on the show courts, if you will, whether that was at the colony or the club, the voluntary club. And so he just, you know, he had a great eye for talent. He had a great eye for little things in terms of the mechanics. He was big on early preparation, you know, getting the racket back, strong foundation, you know, resembled a lot of John Wooden, just really, really simple, basic fundamentals. And then he would obviously, in the recipe, throw in all his motivational and personal skills, which really, you know, was his key to success.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit later as you go back there to be a coach. But is there any story that stands out to you about Nick and your time as a player at the academy?
I just remember, you know, this is before IMG was built. And so we had a little motel on Manatee Avenue. And that's where the kids were being housed, a little motel. And we also had, you know, how a lot of schools had those little classrooms that they would use. And one night we had everybody was just jammed in this little thing. And he was just so intense. And I think a couple people got caught with marijuana or something, and they were kicked out. And it was just, you know, he was like the godfather coming in there, and then he would just take that, you know, from that classroom or whatever onto the court. And his whole style really was just military style, because he was, you know, a paratrooper in the Army and did well there. That mentality right into mass teaching, which he started up in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, and with less now ratings, whatever the name is. And Vince Lombardi saw him teaching down at the Rockefeller down in Puerto Rico, and that really motivated him, gave him his start, really. And I think Vince Lombardi did help him out a little bit.
Right. Amazing that those two personalities could ever, you know, be on the same tennis court together, which Nick told me at one point Vince Lombardi took a lesson from him. And, you know, Nick actually sent me a copy of the check that Vince Lombardi paid Nick.
Is that right? Yeah. I know Vince said, you know, you really should be working with kids. He saw that in Nick way, way back then.
Yeah. And so you were in on the ground floor of, you know, the mass teaching concept, the first academy and all those things. So, you know, a great experience, I'm sure, for you. When you think back to your high school career and your junior career, what are highlights for you from that?
In tennis in high school and juniors? Yes. Well, high school, I didn't do well at all because I was always playing basketball. And I think John English said that when in the Hall of Fame induction a month or so ago, I was either really good or really bad, because I'd literally not play tennis and then pick up a racket and go play. And so I wasn't very good, you know, for certain parts of the year until I'd been playing tennis for 3 or 4 months. And so, you know, the highlights of my junior career would really started when I was in the 14s. I flew up. You can't do that these days, but I flew by myself all the way up from Kentucky to New York City into LaGuardia. And never forget it. The people were late picking me up, and I had a sign, you know, tennis tournament or something. And I'm sitting outside of the LaGuardia Airport for like 3 hours. I'm 14. I didn't know what was going to go on. You know, those are, you didn't even have a cell phone back in those days.
Right.
And ended up going to play the tournament in Manhasset on Long Island. And I did pretty well, even though I lost a heartbreaker to Greg Holmes, who ended up being a great player. He played Davis Cup for the United States. And two hands on both sides. I lost to him 7-5 in the third, 7-6 in the third. And then I got to the finals of the 14s and beat along the way Ken Flack, Billy Quigley, some other guys. And that was the first time I saw Paul Anacombe play. And then I played with a guy named Mike Smith out of Little Rock. He ended up playing his college tennis at Duke. And we got to the finals and lost. That was really a highlight. That gave me a lot of confidence. And then in the 16s, did fairly well. I think I was top 30, 35 in the nation my first year. And that was inspiring, gave me confidence. And then I guess the main thing would be, you know, when I beat Anacone in the 18s in the Easter Bowl, that was probably the highlight. So not a lot of highlights really with the tennis, trying to combine basketball and tennis today. I mean, back then, being two sports and, but I did get up early, even though a lot of times I didn't play, but a lot of times I'd play, get up at 4:20 and my dad would take me to Circle K. I'd catch a ride. We'd go from Henderson over the Ohio River over to Tri-State Racquet Club in Evansville, Indiana. And I would play tennis from 5:30 to 7:00. And I had my principal, Howard Crittenden, who played basketball at Murray, played a little bit for the New York Knicks or the Globetrotters. And he allowed me to have my study hall my first period. And so I got some tennis in before school. Then I had basketball. So it was, you know, it was a lot on my plate, but I wanted to do it and I had to do it. So, you know, I was just trying to make the best of what I had.
Yep. Well, you decide you're going to go into tennis and that the best pathway for you is to go to college.
And then let me just say this. So this is funny. I mean, so I had went to college and was home over Christmas and I was shooting basketball at the YMCA and the coach's son came up to me. This is my freshman year. He goes, "I cannot believe you went to play tennis and you didn't stick with basketball." I said, "Well, yeah, that's because your dad wanted me on the team. And I guess you guys are mad I didn't play." And he goes, "Well," he goes, "you had a bunch of letters." I said, "Letters? What are you talking about?" And he was telling me, you know, I had letters from Michigan State, Purdue, Indiana, because I was right on the Indiana border. So right. I guess a lot of people could see, and more up north in Big Ten schools that Ohio State for sure, that I could have played for, but I never knew that. And so, as it turned out, I guess it worked out, you know, for the best.
Yeah. Long-term, certainly. So you decide you're going to go to Texas A&M, which at that time was not necessarily a big program. You know, they were Coach Ken had come in, but you were sort of the first big recruit or one of the first big recruits there. What led you to A&M?
So I had to make a decision. You know, I went visited LSU, Arkansas, Kentucky, A&M, maybe one more South Florida, because I think that was when I was at Baltieri's. But I almost went to Kentucky because Kyle Macy either called me or a letter, and they actually said I was going to stay in the only athlete to stay in the Wildcat Lodge other than the basketball players. And that was their pitch, whether it was true or not, that was the pitch. But you know, at that time you weren't there. So there were the courts didn't have university courts. You had to play at the racquet club or something. Whereas down at A&M, the weather was good. You know, we had our own courts. And the program was my first year, I think we might've been top 20 around 18 or 19. So it was a little bit established. We did a lot more after that. After the 4 years I was there, we got up to like 6 or 7 in the country. But it was really the weather and that conference, and I wanted to be a pro. And I just felt like it was the best place to go.
Well, you have a great career there. And correct me if I'm wrong, for a long time, you were the all-time singles win leader at A&M.
For a while, I was, yes.
So, and you played high in the lineup. You played, I know, number one, at least part of your career. Did you start at number one, or did you start lower than that and work your way up?
No, I started at number five, I believe, my freshman year, five, and then maybe four. We had some good players. We had Brian Jolson, and, he ended up, he didn't play pro right away out of college, and he went to the business world and felt like he was missing, not being, giving it all he had. And he turned pro. He actually qualified for Wimbledon, lost to Amos Mansdorf 7-5 in the fifth. Really good players. Mike Pazoric out of state of Washington, Kimmo Alkio, who played Davis Cup for Finland. So we had a really good team, Tom Judson. And so I played lower and didn't play number one until my junior year, which was probably my best year. I just remember having some good wins, a few good wins over like Andy Solis, who played one for Alabama, and Kelly Everton twice, and a few other guys. David Egdes played one for Trinity, beat him. He ended up being the president of the World Team Tennis for quite a long time. I played doubles with Grant Connell, who was ended up number one in the world, and went to the NCAAs, and we drew the number two seeds, Matt Anger, who was top 25 in singles in the world, and Anthony Emerson. They were seeded two in the NCAAs. We beat them like 1 and 2.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we toyed with them. And then the next round we played Pat Serrett and Kelly Everton of Arkansas. And we beat them easy in straight sets. And Kelly went on to have a great career, ended up being a good friend of mine and in the pros. And then we ended up losing to Pernforth and Alan Miller, and ended up playing on stadium court. And I didn't feel comfortable being on stadium court, and I just was not myself. I remember the coach's wife was in the stands, and a lady made a comment like, "How do these jokers get here? They're not very good at all." And so I didn't play well at all. But that was kind of the highlights there.
Well,
And then I did, Dennis, I did have a low light, if you want to hear my low light.
Okay.
I always dreamed of playing at UCLA and always wore UCLA shirts, being from Kentucky and going out to Los Angeles. That was my dream. And so we went out to play UCLA at their stadium court out there, their nice stadium court. And it was back in the days of the 9-point tiebreaker. Well, I won my match. I beat a guy called Michael Curies. He was 4 in the country. I beat him in straight sets. I think Grant lost to Brad Pierce in number one singles. And anyway, it came down to 4-4 in matches, and it came down to my doubles match. We were playing on Jeff Laparta, who was a great, great player, and probably top 50 in doubles, and David Livingston, who ended up top 100 in doubles. And it came down to 4-4. In the last set tiebreaker, and whoever won the next point won the match. And my partner served, he missed his first serve, served his second serve, double faulted. We ended up losing the match, and I've never spoke to my partner since. That one hurt really, really bad. That would have been the ultimate for me to because I wasn't recruited. I didn't have a high enough ranking, to do something like that. And so it would have been really the icing on the cake if we could have won that last point.
Right. So were you the first All-American in A&M history in singles or doubles or?
With Grant, yeah. And I don't know, I always just said it was me and Grant, but I guess you call it co-All-American or whatever. I missed the singles. I lost to one around at the NCAAs and lost to Dan Goldy, who was number one seed in a very close match. Well, the score wasn't that close, but I just remember Dick Gould coming over and saying we had about 8 or 9 3-all games, and how the match could have went either way, which really wasn't true. And I really appreciated Dick coming over and giving me those words of encouragement. He was really a class act and obviously a legend.
Yes. You know, it got to be the best ever. And Danny Goldie's a great player, great backhand, as I remember it. Is there anything else you want to say about your time at A&M? I know you had a special relationship with your coach, David Kent.
Well, yeah, Coach Kent was awesome. I mean, you know, he's in the Texas Hall of Fame. He had a great personality, great motivator. I'll tell you a story. Him and Jerry Simmons started at office tennis coaches out in West Texas and worked their way up. And David Kent ended up at Texas A&M and Jerry Simmons ended up at LSU. And so we were hosting LSU and we were warming up in the morning. We warmed up first. And then our coach said to Jerry, he said, "You guys are welcome to the locker rooms and the office and watch TV. We'll see you guys at 1 o'clock. And Coach and Jerry, you know, had known each other a long time. And our coach knew how competitive Jerry was. And so he left a fake lineup on his desk. And so when it came time to exchange lineups, and when Jerry saw that fake lineup and he had put down the wrong players, which he thought to give him the best chance to win the match, his face turned red. It was like smoke came out of his ears. He started cussing and we were just laughing our butts off and we ended up winning 5-4. So I think it made a difference. It was hilarious. And then my freshman year, we were playing Houston. And Houston is not, I mean, the University of Houston's not in the best part of town. And so I'm warming up before the match and I see an imprint or an outline of a dead body. Somebody was murdered on the baseline. And I was warming up thinking, you know, is this spirit going to come through me? It's going to be a rough day today, boy. and it sure did turn out that way. So they had the kegs of beer out for the matches, get all the students out to watch tennis, right? And this one guy was being very rude and obnoxious around our coach's wife, who was very conservative. She was a Sunday school teacher, and he was just cussing up a storm. Our coach went up there and was in his face, and they got into it. And 45 minutes later, the guy was still going at it. He went up there again, and they got into it. Well, subsequently, we lost the match. We're driving home in the white van. Nobody's saying a word. And coach goes, "All right, guys, we got to get ready for Texas." He goes, "We got to start to get our minds going that way. Just forget about this match." And he goes, "That remember that jerk who was being rude to my wife?" And everyone was chiming in, "Yeah, he had no class. How could he talk that way in front of people?" And our coach goes, "Well, that's okay." And he rolls down the window and he had his car keys and threw them out on the freeway. And, so that changed everybody's mood right away, and we were ready for Texas from that moment on.
Oh gosh, what a great person David Kent was! And so your career ends at A&M, and you decide now you got a career decision to make. You've always wanted to play pro tennis, so you go out and play on the tour. What were the highlights of that for you? What were your best wins, and how long did you play?
Well, it was very bittersweet. I had a very, very rough pro career, which I thought I was going to do well. I didn't do really well at all in terms of money or in terms of recognition at the highest level. But the lower rank, you know, tournaments, whether challengers or satellites, you know, I beat Andre Agassi, Brad Gilbert, Sammy Giamava, guys like that. So I could play pretty much at a very high level, but I would also lose a lot. And I had a bunch of really tough losses. Like I lost to a guy named Robert Green, 7-6 in the third. 2 to 3 weeks later, he was in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open.
I lost to
Greg Rozetsky. I got a wild card into Orlando. I lost to Greg Rozetsky, 7-6 in the third. And then after that, we ended up playing about 4 or 5 doubles tournaments together, and we did very, very well. I had a couple really bad heartbreakers, Kelly Everton in New Haven, 6 in the third. I lost a lot of 6s in the third, and never really thought much of it. There's some other, you know, big names. I can't really think off the top of my head, but just really good players that I ended up losing to. David Pate, 7'5", 6'4" and a third, you know, guys like that. He went on to be number one in the world. And I really believe after looking back on it, and it took me many, many years, and probably only until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, this is like 2022, maybe around 2016, that I didn't really have God first in my life. And so I lost a lot of matches. I felt like, you know, if I had really put him first and was leaning on him, it would have made a difference. So that's kind of how I look at it. And I really believe that to this day.
Well, and hopefully you feel like, you know, that led you to a deeper relationship. And I know your father had a big impact on you in that way. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was, you know, he was a disciplinarian. He was a school principal. He was deep rooted in his faith. And so that was, you know, we were going to church all the time, and, you know, just, he was really, really strict, and it was really good because, you know, he taught me and my brother our life values, you know, just really just old Southern stuff, you know, be on time. You mean what you say, your word is to be taken serious, those sort of things, you know, that just carried over. And, but he was a great dad. He really put no pressure on me at all. And, really couldn't have had a better dad. He was awesome. And then, they retired, him and my mom moved down here to Bradenton, and, he belonged to Elk and Keister Country Club, which is where I live now. And, he would always have a cross stenciled on his racket, and he took a lot of grief for that. And so it would kind of irritate me a little bit, you know, sometimes. But I understood where he was coming from, because, maybe at the time, you know, I wasn't deep rooted in my faith as I should have been. And then as time went on, it started, you know, resonating with me that, wow, that really, you know, it took some courage, even though it was not a huge thing, but I had never seen anyone, I've been all over the world, do that. And, so I came up with the idea, just before the induction to the Hall of Fame, that, I wanted to start a movement, and I've already got an LLC, a company, going to have a website, and really try to promote, you know, the Christianity, the movement around the world through tennis. And I just think it'd be awesome to, you know, wherever you travel, you go to a park, whatever, and, you know, you see a couple crosses on rackets out there. Who knows what that may do, and what kind of effect that could have worldwide. So that's the goal. That's the vision. And I hope it, you know, materializes.
Yeah. I hope you're able to pay it forward like that. Tell me okay, let's just talk about one match of your pro career before we talk about, you know, your career as a coach. Uh-huh. You play Andre Agassi. Do you think he's going to end up being number one in the world and a Grand Slam champion?
Well, I knew he would be top 10, which is really, that's, you know, a hard thing to say, or whether top 10, top 20. I knew he was going to be great. He just had the best hands, and he was fairly young. He was 17 at the time. And I beat him 6 months later. He was 3 in the world, but I beat him up in St. Joseph, Missouri, which my best surface was indoors. We had split sets, and they had some stands inside. They blocked off a court, and there was a good crowd there. And his brother was kind of mouthing some stuff like, Andre, you need to really beat him 6-1 or something. And I had a friend in the stands, ended up playing at Texas Tech, and him and Andre's brother kind of got in a little bit. And I happened to win the match 7-5 in the third. But it was ironic. I don't know if she was a pro, but she was very significant at Tri-State Racquet Club. Well, she was a pro, not necessarily my pro, and maybe was. Her name was Miss Sublett. Linda Sublett, and she ended up being the top ranked official in the United States. She was kind of like the pioneer for officials and umpires. And she just so happened to be in the chair that day. Maybe that's why it gave me a slight advantage, but I just remember that very shortly after that, maybe a year, I was went on to work at for Nick, and you know, ended up working with Andre as well.
Now, how did that come about? You end up working for Nick. How did that happen?
So I was playing Indianapolis, and I don't chronologically, the way my life is, I've been all over the world, lived in four continents, Australia, Croatia, Manhattan, Alabama, everywhere. So I might be a year or two off, but was playing in Indianapolis and I lost. And I told Nick, I said, I'm going to quit. I have no confidence. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to teach tennis. He said, well, come work for me. And I said, really? He said, absolutely. He said, you can be my right-hand man. And I said, well, that's great. I'll be down there in about 3 or 4 weeks. He said, well, why is that? I said, well, you're not going to believe it, but Madonna's doing a movie in Evansville, Indiana called A League of Their Own, a baseball movie. And she happens to be renting out a house that has a tennis court. And I pointed to two people. We were in the players' lounge. I said, those two people over there, I got tickets to the tournament. That's their house that Madonna's going to stay in. And they want, Madonna wants me to give her lessons. We got it all set up. And I'll give you the G version. He said, the hell with Madonna, you start on Monday.
Yeah.
And so I said, all right. I said, I can see where this is going to be pretty interesting working for this cat. And so I needed a car, and my dad had an old Stingray 74 red Corvette convertible. And so I bought that for my dad for 10 grand. And I get down to Bradenton, and a month or two later, I'm looking it up on the Kelley Blue Book, and it was really worth $7,500. So he made about $2,500 off of me on that. And I was like, you got to be kidding me.
So you work for Nick, and you know, this is really, he is by that time, the number one coach in the world, and it opens all kinds of doors for you. And kind of what I want to talk to you about is these players. And I want you to tell me a story or a quick impression of each player, either way.
Yeah.
You worked with Maria Sharapova. What about her?
So Maria came to the academy at either 7 or 8, and she was sponsored by IMG, and you know, they put them up, whether it was 75 grand a year, whatever it may be. And Yuri was her dad, and Marcia was the mother. And, you know, we were just in their lives every day. And Maria was on the court. I had her on the court almost every day at a young age, and you knew she was going to be good. I knew she was going to be one or two or top five in the world when she won Eddie Herr at 14, just to see how she fought. She was like a little Jimmy Connors, just so intense. And just hit the ball so clean, but her tenacity and her energy and enthusiasm was really second to none. I knew she was going to make it.
Now, what is there anything, and I know this is a tough question, but is there anything you feel like you were able to help her with?
No. I don't think I did, to be in respect to her. Some others I did for sure. But like Tommy Haas, I believe I helped him a lot with his one-handed backhand. I had a pretty good one-handed backhand. But with Maria, no. I do remember us, me and Maria and Nick, doing a clinic for about 700 coaches at the U.S. Open on a court. You know, they had us all mic'd up. And she was, I don't know how old she was, 10 or 11. She was young. And we were doing angles, and I remember just doing angles with her, saying, this girl's going to make it. You know, she can just put the ball on a dime. And that's one of the things working there at the academy with your Tommy Haas's at a young age, your Max Murney, all the ones that came up at a really young age that were there. looking back, you could just tell that they had it. You know, you can tell certain ones had it and the other ones didn't. And she was one of those that I felt was going to make it 100%.
Yeah. So Tommy Haas also lived there for, you know, came at a young age and ends up being number two in the world. How were you able to help him with this one-handed backhand?
Well, I'm big, you know, first it all starts with the grip. But he came over. I was the first one to hit with him when he came to the United States or the academy. He was 11 or 12, and then he might have went back to Germany. He didn't like it. Then he came back. But anyway, there for a while, he didn't know if he was going to go two or one. So he was hitting a two-handed backhand for a while. Obviously, you know, a little bit better with the return of serve. And then he went back to a one. Then he would go back to a two. Then he would come back to a one. And little things, you know, I like to keep the left shoulder back, stay sideways, and then, you know, come up with your style of the follow through. He liked to flop his hand over a little bit. He would take a recovery step, which was really all of Nick. Nick was really big about taking the recovery step. But just hitting backhands with him every day, making sure he had it clean, you know, was doing the right technique and that sort of a thing and building his confidence. But Tommy was really, I'd say, the number one guy. Well, Maria was too, but those top ones that made it, that if you told them something one time, they got it. You didn't have to tell them twice. And that's what stuck with me with Tommy Haas.
Anna Kournikova, how much did you work with her?
I had Anna every day at 8 o'clock, and one day she showed up and we were given a lesson, as we always do prior to 8 o'clock. We actually start at 6 a.m. and she walked on the court. It was right at 8, and she said, "Okay, people, it's my time now. Get off the court. I'm here." And you would start laughing, you know, and she was a real hard worker. But she had a fire and she would go for the jugular. Nick always said, "Don't let that little smile fool you, because, she'll put her foot on your throat when it's time to do that." And that's how she was. And I always felt like she got a bad rap. You know, she was a pretty girl and got a lot of, recognition for that, being a good player. And then as she really got into the pros, I think a lot of the media kind of they piggyback off one another, what this person said. And then she got the stigma that she wasn't a very good tennis player. In singles, ended up winning, you know, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 grand slams and doubles, played a lot with Martina Hingis, which I thought was unfair to her. And when I was coaching Eva Maioli, she won the French Open and 98. And then we were coaching. I was with Eva after that, and we were playing Rome, and we were in the quarters of Rome playing Anna. And I remember thinking we had a pretty good shot of winning the match. I wasn't really that thinking that actually Anna would win, and Anna ended up beating Eva on clay in Rome. And so the girl could play. She just had that stigma. She couldn't play singles, and I just think that's just it's so wrong. That, you know, you don't have to win. I don't think she ever won a singles title, but, you know, if you're 8 in the world in anything, you're pretty darn good.
Yeah. And she won a couple doubles, grand slams, right?
With absolutely. Hingis. Yeah.
Yeah.
She played her best with her and Martina Hingis.
Right. Now, you mentioned Maioli, who I was going to talk about. And you coached her when she won the Grand Slam at the French. Is that correct?
No, I was not with her when she won the slams. It was gotcha. It was Papa and Drago, her brother. And so she won the French. She beat Martina Hingis 4-2 in 1998. And one day, Nick, I'm on stadium court, and Nick calls me. He says, "Papa and Drago, we want to talk to you." And so we go inside, and Papa says, he says to me, Greggy, he says, "Eva, no, listen to us no more. She went French Open. She thinks she knows it all. Please, we want you to coach Eva." And Drago's like going, "Yes, Greggy, please coach Eva. And I was kind of burnt out and I wanted to travel. So I said, "Sure, I'll do it." So I moved to Croatia. I was in Croatia for like 6 months.
Gotcha.
great experience over there?
Yeah, I mean, with Eva, she was big in the meeting people, and we were living the fast life. We were in Berlin. She actually lost in the semis of Berlin, the German Open. She lost to Hingis. Whether I was with Mary Jo Fernandez, I coached her the year before, or Eva, we never beat Martina Hingis. I was with Mary Jo, I think we lost her four times. We lost to her in Sydney, and then the semifinals of the Australian Open, semifinals of Indian Wells, and the semifinals of Miami. Well, Eva never beat her either. And we were in Berlin, and connections, Eva had them. And Rupert Murdoch sent a private jet, and we took that jet down to Cannes, France, and we met up with Arnon Milchan, who is the most powerful guy in Hollywood. He owned Regency Film, and he was good friends with Rupert, so we were on his yacht for 10 days, and that's how we trained for the French Open. We took a boat from the yacht over to a really nice club and practiced, and at that same time, Arnon's daughter was doing a movie called Goodbye Lover. So me and Eva, we went up the red carpet with Don Johnson and Ellen DeGeneres and a bunch of people that were in the cast. Oh, and so, you know, you're living in the fast life. They're taking the pictures. You're going up the red carpet. And it's another lifestyle, you know. And that proceeded to really be Eva's downfall. And we came back to the States, and we were out in Malibu with Arnon. You know, and then, well, even in Paris, you know, we're with Naomi Campbell and Bruce Willis and all these people, all because of Arnon. And Arnon owned Puma at the time. So back in the early 90s, in the late 80s, in the 90s, you saw a lot of the Hollywood people wear Puma. And right. that was because of Arnon Milchan.
Oh,
and if you don't know who Arnon is, for the people listening, you can Google Arnon Milchan. He's a billionaire. And He's really an original in real life, a James Bond type of a guy. He was in the Israeli intelligence agency. I was home one night watching 60 Minutes. They did a special on him, and he just loved Eva. We were wearing Puma, and we were at his house in Malibu, and just had some really fun times with the people we were hanging out with, Leonardo DiCaprio and different people, and so we. Kind of, well, she got in that lifestyle, and to her demise, over time, it didn't work out, and then I had to stop coaching her because her dad and her brother had to start coaching her again.
You also worked with Venus and Serena. What was that like?
Well, the first thing that popped in my head is that my brother Scott and Fritz now. Were over at Rick Macy's, and they took over Rick's program because Rick decided to go with Venus and Serena on a daily basis, you know, in the AM and in the PM. And so I would go over there to visit my brother and Fritz, and Rick would always put me hitting with the girls. And that was the first, you know, time that I saw them. And I'll never forget, Rick had the girls hitting, you know, they're nine and 10 years old, hitting open stance backhands out in the doubles alley going out wide. And I just thought that was so bizarre. And I remember coming back to tell Nick, and he goes, he didn't know what he's talking about, you know. A little bit different in the philosophies back then, but Rick turned out to be right in terms of the open stance. But got to know Richard really well. I'll never forget it. He took me, he says, come here, I want to show you something. And he took me to the parking lot. He had a purple Impala back then, and opened up the trunk, and that's where he revealed the $8 million contract that they signed with Reebok. And then, you know, over the years, I think they stopped coming to the Academy a little bit because of Anna Kournikova. They had different personalities, and it didn't gel that well. But over time, Venus and Serena started coming back a lot more, and I would usually be the one to work with them. And actually, John Watson, too, who's from Richmond, Kentucky, played at Kentucky. We were, and my brother would usually be the ones that would take the Williams sisters, and just got to know them. Really nice girls, and very hard workers, but they were on a mission, and they believed it, and it materialized, and it was, you know, it's a great story.
Yeah. Now, any funny Richard Williams stories other than revealing the contract?
I don't want to get in trouble, but one time I had to meet him in the middle of the state and I had to pick up 10 grand and, I met him at Burger King and he was going to really make it big in singing. So I had to listen and he was in a black Mercedes and I had to listen to him sing for about 5 minutes. And that was quite an experience, but Richard was the visionary and he actually on that trip took me, I can't remember if it was Indian Town, but it was right in the middle or Okeechobee. And took me around the corner and showed me a couple of the houses that the girls had refurbished for single women that were single parents. They were really beautiful colors and where the women could, you know, have pride in where they live. And he showed me those. And then he took me to an old place that had old Greyhound buses that he was going to refurbish and make a business. And so he was always thinking about the future. And he... when I was coaching Fast Forward, Vince Spady in 2005, I was in the tunnel and ran into Richard and he said, thank you so much for helping my girls. And I said, well, what are you up to? And he said how he was going to make a lot of money in podcasts. And ironically, that's what me and you are on today. and that was in 2005. So he was always thinking ahead. He had a very good business mind.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, you know, I want to kind of conclude this portion of the interview talking about Nick. But before we do that, is there anybody else you want to talk about your experiences with as a pro coach?
Well, I was thinking about that earlier. You know, so I coached Marcelo Rios, who people in the tennis world back in those days know who he was. He ended up number one in the world from Santiago, Chile. To me, he had the best hands ever, even to this day. His hands were just incredible. And, he was a little different. He was a lefty and he could not bend his right leg on his backhand. His left leg, cause he was left-handed on his two-handed backhand. And we just tried to get him but he couldn't bend it, but his backhand was awesome.
Yeah.
And he was just so talented. He could get away with it. And he would work so hard. I'd go to Santiago and we'd go to the track and he would just do these 440s and just kill himself, you know, which nobody ever saw. And even with Andre, when I used to go to Vegas and Gil Reyes, we were doing weights where Gil had this one machine back in the day. I guess they didn't have it where you just get under it and you do your squats and the machine would release and you're on your own. And I told Andre I would beat him because I thought I was a big basketball player and I could dunk it and all this stuff. And I did 13 and Andre did 28. And that showed me how much work that they were doing that people didn't realize that, you know, Andre's image is everything, you know, with the sunglass commercial and all that stuff. But he was working so hard that for some reason, you know, he didn't want people to know that. They kept that hidden. And that's how Marcelo was. And he, you know, he had trouble socializing and really was not very popular with the fans or the media. And come to find out, he probably had Asperger's syndrome, which a lot of your really intelligent people like Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, and Charles Darwin, all those guys supposedly had it, I guess. And that's one of the reasons he really had trouble dealing with people in the media and so, you know, people like that, giving autographs and all that sort of thing. But I was supposed to play golf with him the other day. He lives here in Sarasota now, and we're probably going to play in a few weeks.
How about that? Hey, let's just conclude this section here with Nick Bollettieri. What has he meant in your life?
I
don't mean for you to have to repeat anything we said earlier, just anything in addition.
Well, you know, he's helped my family. He's always given us jobs and a place to go back. And my brother had some cancer issues and we didn't know, you know, if he was going to even lose his whole lip, and he found a good doctor, and we made some real good decisions that really helped my brother Scott in that regard. But I don't know, just basic values that I learned from Nick. I think the number one that stands out is that Nick had no fear. Many, many times I've been with him to where he had to go speak. Like he's speaking to a lot of institutions, be it Harvard or whatever. Many times I've been with him, like when he was inducted into the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame, and you know, we'd be on the airplane going down, and he goes, "What do you think I should speak about?" And I would give him some bullet points, and he would always pull it off, you know, and he would never really use anything I said. But he never, you know, like he got his honorary doctorate degree from a university up in New York City. And the guy always would make these amazing speeches. And as time went on, as he got in his 70s, really loved to do public speaking because he's a motivator, you know, and it just comes very natural for him to be in front of people. And he always pulled it off. And no matter how big the stage, like I was saying, me and him and Sharapova did a thing for 700 coaches at the U.S. Open. He just comes out shining even brighter than you think going into it that he would. And he's just amazing that way. But I think he had no fear. And then one thing, he never would procrastinate. He always had the mentality to do it right now, whether it was a book, whether it was an idea, whether it was a phone call. I mean, he'll call you, you know, 11 o'clock at night. He's not going to, you know, well, say I might hurt this guy's feelings or whatever. You know, he always does things right away, which I think is a great thing. You know, a lot of people procrastinate. I know I do. And just little stuff like that really, you know, helped me going forward. So he was awesome.
That's great. Greg, what are you doing now?
I teach tennis out at Lakewood Ranch Golf and Country Club. It's a big country club east of I-75, which is east of Sarasota Bradenton. And I'm the junior director, and I've been out there about 9 years now. And it's a great job for me as I get older, where I don't really want to hit with like high level players and travel or go on the weekends. And so, we got a big group out there this summer, about 60 kids. And I do that Monday through Friday and then just teach lessons. And so it's very relaxed, totally different than, you know, when you're working for Nick or the academy or even coaching pro players on the pro tour, which a lot of people don't realize the pressure and anxiety that goes with that. You know, you travel all the way to the country and you may lose first round, and all the work that you did goes down the tubes when you lose that match. And then you got to get on the phone with the mom or the dad and the agent, which I'll never forget when me and Marcelo were at the Canadian Open in Toronto, and Marcelo's just toying with people. He beat Patrick Rafter 1 and 2, and he beat Johansson 1 and 2. And he ends up playing Woodridge in the semifinals. Todd Woodbridge, who was more predominantly a doubles player, number one in the world. But Todd was good in singles. He was 20 in the world, I think, at the time.
Uh-huh.
Well, Woodbridge beat Marcelo 2-1 in the semis, and Marcelo, he pretty much tanked. And we had the big Colombian coffee guy with the big hat. He was there in the front row, and we got booed out of the stadium, and so I go in the locker room and I just lost it. And I go crazy. And he goes, "I can't feel ball, no ball, no, I cannot feel ball, no ball." and come to find out a week or two later, he had girl issues or whatever. But, those kind of experiences, when you go travel like that and you put all the effort into it and somebody loses, not easy. And I go back to the hotel and his agent, Jeff Schwartz, calls me. Well, Jeff's the number one agent for the NBA, and he has been for about 6 or 7 years now. And me and Jeff were pretty tight, and he was going crazy on me on the telephone. You know, how could he lose a player? The guy's a nobody, you know, and so you got everybody coming down on you. So there's a lot of pressure. It may seem glamorous, but you still have to perform, you know, and the one dynamic is that the player is your boss. And so, you know, if they don't want to practice, they don't practice. I mean, you can make your suggestions and you can be tough with them, you know, but and there's different examples out there. It may not last, you know, but so you got to fill that out, that dynamic out. But it is interesting traveling with somebody like that because you're eating with them, you're on the plane with them, you're having dinner with them all the time, and you're in each other's faces, and it can wear on you, you know, pretty quickly. I guess that's why, you know, most relationships don't last that long.
Yeah, and so you obviously enjoy being at the club. Anything else you have going on that you want to share with us?
Well, yeah, I mean, So I started two companies. One is Cross Tennis, where basically you stencil the cross on the racket, and I'm going to try to build that. And, you know, I do have a vision for that. I want it to go worldwide, globally, internationally, all over the world. And just, you know, cause we only have so much time here on earth. And so I want to see what I can do in that regard. And then starting to get a little bit into long distance learning, which Vimal Patel kind of turned me on to after the Hall of Fame thing. We were flying back together and he mentioned that to me, and he kind of has guided me a little bit on that. So I got those two things going on. We'll see what happens.
Well, that sounds great. Greg, thank you for your time. Congratulations on being in the Hall of Fame. And we sure do appreciate all you have done and the way you represented the state.
Well, thanks, Dennis. I always say you can take the boy out of Kentucky, but you can't take Kentucky out of the boy.
Thanks, you, Dennis. Greg.